Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Robert Young-Pelton, an author, filmmaker, journalist, explorer, and the founder and publisher of SomaliaReport.com. He's had a first-hand perspective on the war on terror from direct contact with the world's most infamous jihadi, rebel, and insurgent groups. And his books include The World's Most Dangerous Places, Come Back Alive, Three Worlds Gone Mad, License to Kill, Hired Guns in the War on Terror, and his autobiography, The Adventurist. He has an article at Foreign Policy, Hijacked, How the UN Saved the Somali Pirates from the Brink of Extinction. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Young-Pelton.
Hi, Ian. Always a pleasure.
So, Robert, the Kenyans, or the African Union, I think they're largely Kenyan, along with some Somali forces, appear to have driven, Al-Shabaab actually just leave Kismayo, the port?
The Kenyan army fights probably a little bit more enthusiastically with their press releases than they do on the ground. They actually landed north of the city. And Al-Shabaab did mention that they're making an organized retreat. It remains to be seen whether they're actually retreating or not, but the Kenyans have never actually fought a war before, so this is their first war, and they tend to, overstep their capabilities sometimes. So it's yet to be seen.
Well, apparently, though, they're in the ensuing power vacuum, a number of influential clan figures have been murdered in the past few days, presumably by Al-Shabaab. Is that right?
Yeah, there's a big race for Kismayo. You know, Kismayo is the second largest port in Somalia. It's just south of Mogadishu. And for many, many years, Kismayo has kept their port fees down so that people will drop off, let's say, a shipload. They'll drop off two or three things in Mogadishu and then go down south to Kismayo. And Al-Shabaab and the local governor have been making a lot of money off of this as discount port service. So what Kenya's trying to do is dislodge them from Kismayo to cut off their source of income.
So when the Kenyans say that they are hosting 650,000 refugees from Somalia, and they've had instability on their border with the murder of some foreign tourists or aid workers, do they have a case for needing to invade their northern neighbor in the name of stability?
I think so. I think any nation has the right to defend their borders, even if they have to go slightly inside the other borders. But if you look at the history of Kenya and Somalia, Somalia has always had sort of a buffer zone. The British used to call it Jubaland. And if you remember the stories about shiftas and cattle rustlers and poachers, you know, Somali clans and gangs used to come south into Kenya and steal cattle. So historically, there's been a history of Kenyan troops chasing, you know, bandits up into Somalia. But this is a much, much bigger thing. This is about 5,000 traditional ground troops being paid about $1,028 a month by the Amazon organization, which is a part of AU, but is essentially bankrolled by the African Union, which is bankrolled by EU and the United States. So it's a major political shift in the region. And they want to have control over that southern boundary. So you're going to see a lot of people squabbling. The basic clans, the Ogadanis, the Kenyans, the Somalis, are all going to be fighting over who controls that political structure around Kismayo.
So Kismayo, though, was a port for pirates, wasn't it?
No, Kismayo, strangely enough, most people think pirates are everywhere. Piracy has always been north, in the central areas and up into Puntland. Al-Shabaab actually has kept pirates and piracy out of the south. There have been bandits that have been labeled as pirates. If you remember the Marie Dijot, who was kidnapped and then she died, and then the British couple whose husband was shot and the wife was then ransomed. These people are very careful to put plywood between criminal acts and terrorist acts because you can't pay ransoms to terrorist groups. So whenever you hear these people talk, they say, oh, no, we're criminals, we're not terrorists, or we're terrorists, we're not criminals. But they are linked, and what Kenya is trying to do is just simply grab a hold of the control of that region to, first of all, flush out Al-Shabaab, but also to get a handle on this criminal activity.
So, again, I'm speaking with Robert Young Pelton, author, filmmaker, journalist, explorer, and the founder and publisher of Somalia Report. He has an article at Foreign Policy Hijacked, How the UN Saved the Somali Pirates from the Brink of Extinction. And obviously, we want to talk about that. But just to finish up on al-Shabaab, you know, it's always said in the same breath, al-Shabaab, al-Qaeda affiliated or whatever. And we keep hearing about al-Qaeda's ubiquitous reach all around the world. And it's hard to get a handle on whether they really, how much of it is exaggeration, how much of it's real. Give me your assessment of this, their affiliation, how real they are, and whether this is going to be another fertile ground for al-Qaeda.
Well, historically, you have to go back. Remember that this area, the Swahili area, has always clashed with the sort of inland animist Christian. And if you also go back not too recently, you'll find out that this was actually the nexus of Osama bin Laden and al-Qaeda. And they blew up the embassy in Tanzania, and they blew up another one in Kenya, and they tried to blow up one in Uganda, but it was thwarted. And there's been a very robust anti-terrorism program to root out and kill those original members of al-Qaeda. So al-Qaeda is very real in that area. Secondly, al-Shabaab was the more fundamental, the Wahhabist element of the Islamic courts, which took over Somalia and then was kicked out by Ethiopia, which then created sort of this Frankenstein called al-Shabaab.
Now, Robert, was that an export from our wonderful allies, the Saudis, who export Wahhabism? Are they responsible for?
If you look at the coast of Africa, there are very strong Muslim communities, and some of those Muslim communities feel downtrodden, and they align themselves with almost missionary zeal. And you'll see that some elements, even within Nairobi and some of the internal cities, are very much aligned with, you know, return to the old roots. And Gulf and Saudi sponsors go out of their way to fund groups like that, much like, you know, Baptist missionaries want to reach out and find like-minded people all around the world. It went kind of crazy when bin Laden went there. Remember, he moved to Khartoum, and he began to actively support a number of people who were planning bombing attacks against the U.S. So there's no sort of Saudi government payroll, but yes, there is an affinity between the Wahhabist government of Saudi Arabia and a lot of the coastal Swahili areas.
Well, of course, we all remember under President George H.W. Bush that the U.S. intervened in Somalia largely for humanitarian reasons, because there was massive starvation. And then it ended up in the sort of infamy of Black Hawk Down. And President Clinton quickly got out of there. So there's a kind of bitter taste, I think, in terms of America about Somalia. Is it a permanently failed state? I mean, is it redeemable, rescuable?
Well, here's the thing. I mean, on Western terms, we're trying to reconstruct the colonial thing called Somalia, which was made out of clans, which then turned into protectorates. And a lot of modern Somalis want a unified Somalia. But when you actually go to Somalia, you won't find lawlessness. You'll find all these small regional governments doing just fine with their own traditional and sort of regional governments. So there's a lot of friction between an outside entity, which in this case is the UN, which has babysat Somalia for 20 years, to try to make it look like it did 20 some odd years ago, back when it dissolved into civil war. But the problem is that Somalis want to create their own state, and it doesn't necessarily look like the map that the UN has out. It includes Somaliland, which is now separate in the north, Puntland, which is semi-autonomous, Galmudug, which is a lawless area in the center, and then the southern part, which is where all the money comes from and where all the famine and all the aid goes to.
So let's turn then to Robert Young Pelton, to your article at Foreign Policy Hijacked, How the UN Saved the Somali Pirates from the Brink of Extinction. Now, you just mentioned how the UN are still insisting on this old kind of colonial model. that has little to do with the ethnic reality on the ground. But how in God's name could the United Nations save pirates from extinction? I mean, what happened?
Well, the first thing is that the UN is not monolithic. So on one hand, you can have an agency basically lecturing local governments in Somalia saying, you have to take action against the pirates. You have to train security forces and kick these pirates out. And then on the other hand, you have a group called the Somali-Eritrean Mining Group, which is watching the 20-year-old arms embargo, which was set in place when the militias went crazy back in the early 90s. And they are monitoring anybody, and that includes the CIA, the United States, anybody who has a weapon that isn't authorized by the UN. So Puntland, which is the region in the northeast corner, waited years and years and years for the UN to say, okay, here's the money, go start this. And they couldn't wait anymore, so they went to the UAE, and the UAE said, here, we'll pay you about $10 million, go out and hire some trainers, which happened to be the old Executive Outcomes Group, and put together a 1,000-man anti-piracy group with helicopters, fast boats, and aviation assets, everything, a real army.
Now, that was put together by an ex-CIA guy, wasn't it?
It was a group of people. It wasn't just one. It was an ambassador. It was an ex-CIA.
Yeah, Pierre Prosper was one of them.
Yep, and then also Lafosse Lutink. I can't pronounce his name properly, but he was one of the founders of Executive Outcomes.
And that was the South African mercenary group, right? The Executive Outcomes.
Right, exactly. Which doesn't exist anymore, but the basic people have been working in Iraq and Afghanistan. So they came in as trainers, and they trained up the Somali force that then set their sights on specific pirate groups in specific areas sometime in June. And what was happening was the monitoring group of the UN was strong-arming the UAE and Puntland and the Somali government to stop this because it was the largest single force inside Somalia. And what they did is they threatened it with sanctions, and the UN can take three anonymous people and actually sanction your travel and your bank accounts, and there is no court of recourse. So it's a very serious thing if they recommend sanctions. So the reason I wrote this article is because I talked to the folks at the SCMG, and I talked to spent quite a bit of time on the ground with the mercenary group and in pirate areas, and I thought it was a good thing that they were actually chasing the pirates out. And then on June 6th, the program was entirely shut down just before the UN report came out. So my guess was that the UAE was threatened with sanctions if they didn't immediately stop funding this activity. So they had pirates on the run. They had a pirate who had a super tanker who was moving it around trying to keep it away from the South Africans, and another chemical tanker, and then suddenly it just stopped. All these people were told to pack up, get out of the country. And when I read the report, it was just blistering about how sanctions should be brought against Lafosse and the South Africans. And I was looking for the part where it was going to say the same thing about the pirates. And it didn't. And I called the UN and I said, well, explain this. And they said, oh, well, we can't sanction the pirates because then you couldn't pay the ransoms to free the people. So that was enough to put this...
We were just talking, Robert Young-Pelton, about in the first segment about how the UN blew the opportunity to get rid of Karzai with a massive fraud in the elections. I mean, this is just another example of this wonderful bureaucracy run amok.
Right, and the difference is that Somalia is a ward of the UN ever since the government fell apart in 91. The UN has been given responsibility for this orphan, and Somalis have continually tried to create their own institutions, and they've been smacked down by the UN because it doesn't match the map that the UN puts out. And the map that the UN puts out glues all these beautiful places together like a country, but it's not. It's just four very separate, different places.
So let's then return to this military invasion by the African Union troops, largely Kenyan soldiers, funded, I guess, when you say they're funded by the EU and by the United States, is how much could you describe them as mercenaries? I mean...
Well, here's the reason. What they've done is they've done the legal work so that you can't technically call them mercenaries, but to the Somalis, they're foreign invaders, which was the whole reason why al-Shabaab came to such strength, because they don't want foreign countries, particularly neighbors, to invade their country and to dictate how to run their country. And the Djibouti Accord, which was created after the Ethiopians invaded and were pushed out again, was specifically to keep neighbors from meddling. That's why you see Ugandans and Burundians and Djiboutians. So when Kenya invaded, it was very, very embarrassing. So they had to rewrite all these rules to make them peacekeepers, even though they said we're going all the way to Kismayo, we're going to kick out al-Shabaab. So once again, they've magically been transformed into legally conforming mercenaries.
But presumably the U.S. has an interest in that. They have a lot of activity down there, aren't there? Ships and drones, and isn't there an anti-Al-Qaeda strategy? You pointed out that one of the first targets that the Al-Qaeda, bin Laden, went after were the embassies nearby in Africa. So,
The U.S. has their new proxy forces. So in Libya, in Somalia, you don't see very many Americans on the ground. You might see a handful here and there. But what they're doing is they're using proxy forces. So they literally fly aircraft that have no markings and pretend like they're Somalis out of Djibouti and do raids inside Somaliland and Puntland. They train up security forces using, U.S. money. So they're very active in that region, but they stay away from it. They stay on the ships, they stay in the Seychelles and Djibouti, and they don't have a base, per se, in the country.
No boots on the ground, but then really running the show, though.
Right. Well, you can find them by the airport. There's a CIA base right by the airport as you land in Mogadishu, and I bumped into trainers out in the wilderness training the anti-terrorism forces, but you won't see any large, not like Afghanistan or Iraq or any such large contingents on there.
Well, we were just speaking earlier about the surge in Afghanistan and how it's essentially amounted to nothing because of the kind of whack-a-mole nature of these things, where the insurgents just melt off. And the first guest described it as a water balloon that you squeeze. Is this the same situation here, where the al-Shabaab are just going to melt off and come back?
No, the big difference is that we don't want to grab the tar baby. We don't want to go into Somalia because we know it's going to be very difficult coming out. In Afghanistan, we went in and we're trying to figure out how to get out. There was no surge. Numerically, there was no surge in troops. There was a reassignment and they were rotating some people, but we never had a major offensive to remove the Taliban. We sort of did it here or there, what they call centers of gravity. But all the Taliban have to do is sit in the tea shop and wait until we pick another center of gravity and go back to work.
But so so al-Shabaab, is there a way that this can work and that you could get rid of the instability in Somalia? I mean,
Somalia's very different. Somalia has a huge diaspora that's extremely aggressive in investing and helping. Most Somalis are very sophisticated. You can go to the smallest town in the middle of central Somalia and meet a guy from Philadelphia who used to drive a cab who retired from Somalia who speaks perfect English. It's a very different dynamic there, and Somalis are very, very adept at building, reconstructing, training, and it's very impressive. If you go on the ground, every time somebody says a lawless nation, you would be very surprised how efficient it is.
Well, that's very surprising, and we should talk some more about it, but we've run out of time, and I thank you so much for joining us.
Always a pleasure, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Robert Young Pelton, an author, filmmaker, journalist, explorer, and the founder and publisher of SomaliaReport.com. He has had a firsthand perspective on the war on terror from direct contact with the world's most infamous jihadi, rebel, and insurgent groups. And his books include The World's Most Dangerous Places, Come Back Alive, Three Worlds Gone Mad, License to Kill, Hired Guns in the War on Terror, and his autobiography, The Adventurist. He has an article at Foreign Policy Hijacked, How the UN Saved the Somali Pirates from the Brink of Extinction. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about what you won't be hearing in the presidential debate on Wednesday. Children grow, they grow with what they see. And in these times where paranoia closes in, power and hate are rampaging disease. In our minds we build the blocks to what we need.
In our minds we're reaching out for peace. In our hearts we know of such the hills to climb. In our hearts a sense of masterpiece.